Chapter 6. Which, I wish you to see as little of your family as possible. When those duties cease to be required and rendered, and the stipend ceases to be paid, there is an end of all relations between us. Do you understand me? Mrs. Tootle seemed doubtful about it, and as to Tootle himself, he had evidently no doubt whatever that he was all abroad. You have children of your own, said Mr. Dombey. It is not at all in this bargain that you need become attached to my child, or that my child need become attached to you. I don't expect or desire anything of the kind. Quite the reverse. When you go away from here, you will have concluded what is a mere matter of bargain and sale, hiring and letting, and will stay away. The child will cease to remember you, and you will cease, if you please, to remember the child. Mrs. Tootle, with a little more color in her cheeks than she had had before, said she hoped she knew her place. I hope you do, Richards, said Mr. Dombey. I have no doubt you know it very well. Indeed, it is so plain and obvious that it could hardly be otherwise. Louia, my dear, arrange with Richards about money, and let her have it, when and how she pleases. Mr. What's your name, a word with you, if you please. Thus arrested on the threshold as he was following his wife out of the room, Tootle returned and confronted Mr. Dombey alone. He was a strong, loose, round-shouldered, shuffling, shaggy fellow, on whom his clothes sat negligently. With a good deal of hair and whisker, deepened in its natural tint, perhaps by smoke and coal dust. Hard, knotty hands. And a square forehead, as coarse in grain as the bark of an oak. A thorough contrast in all respects to Mr. Dombey, who was one of those close-shaved, close-cut moneyed gentlemen who are glossy and crisp like new banknotes, and who seem to be artificially braced and tightened, as by the stimulating action of golden shower baths. You have a son, I believe? Said Mr. Dombey. Four on them, sir. Four hims and a her. All alive. Why, it's as much as you can afford to keep them. Said Mr. Dombey. I couldn't hardly afford but one thing in the world less, sir. What is that? To lose them, sir. Can you read? Asked Mr. Dombey. Why, not particular, sir. Right? With chalk, sir? With anything? I could make shift to chalk a little bit, I think, if I was put to it, said Tootle after some reflection. And yet, said Mr. Dombey, you are 2 or 33, I suppose. Thereabouts, I suppose, sir, answered Tootle, after more reflection, then why don't you learn? Asked Mr. Dombey. So I may going to, sir. One of my little boys is a going to learn me when he's old enough and been to school himself. Said Mr. Dombey, after looking at him attentively, and with no great favor, as he stood gazing round the room, principally round the ceiling, and still drawing his hand across and across his mouth. You heard what I said to your wife just now? Polly heard it, said Tootle, jerking his hat over his shoulder in the direction of the door, with an air of perfect confidence in his better half. It's all right. But I ask you, if you heard it. You did, I suppose, and understood it? Pursued Mr. Dombey. I heard it, said Tootle, but I don't know as I understood it rightly, sir, account of being no scholar, and the words being ask your pardon rather high. But Polly heard it. It's all right. As you appear to leave everything to her, said Mr. Dombey, frustrated in his intention of impressing his views still more distinctly on the husband, as the stronger character, I suppose it is of no use my saying anything to you. Apostrophe, not a bit, apostrophe said Tootle. Polly heard it. She's awake, sir. Apostrophe, I won't detain you any longer then, apostrophe returned Mr. Dombey, disappointed. Where have you worked all your life? Apostrophe, mostly underground, sir, till I got married. I come to the level then. I may going on one of these here railroads, when they comes into full play. Apostrophe, as he added in one of his hoarse whispers, we means to bring up little Byler to that line, apostrophe Mr. Dombey inquired haughtily who little Byler was. The eldest on them, sir, apostrophe said Tootle, with a smile. It ain't a common name. Sir much sir that when he was took to church the gentleman said, it wham day christen one, and he couldn't give it. But we always calls him Byler just the same. For we don't mean no harm. Not we. Do you mean to say, man, apostrophe inquired Mr. Dombey, looking at him with marked displeasure, that you have called a child after a boiler? Apostrophe apostrophe, no, no, sir, apostrophe returned Tootle, with a tender consideration for his mistake. I should hope not. No, sir. Arter a boiler, sir. The steam engine was amist as good as a godfather to him, and so we called him Byler, don't you see? Apostrophe apostrophe, as the last straw breaks the laden camel's back, this piece of information crushed the sinking spirits of Mr. Dombey. He motioned his child's foster father to the door, who departed by no means unwillingly. And then turning the key, paced up and down the room in solitary wretchedness. It would be harsh, and perhaps not altogether true, to say of him, that he felt these rubs and gratings against his pride more keenly than he had felt his wife's death. But certainly they impressed that event upon him with new force, and communicated to it added weight and bitterness. It was a rude shock to his sense of property in his child, that these people the mere dust of the earth, as he thought them should be necessary to him. And it was natural, that in proportion as he felt disturbed by it, he should deplore the occurrence which had made them so. For all his starched impenetrable dignity and composure, he wiped blinding tears from his eyes as he paced up and down his room, and often said, with an emotion of which he would not, for the world, have had a witness, poor little fellow. Apostrophe apostrophe, it may have been characteristic of Mr. Dombey's pride, that he pitied himself through the child. Not poor me. Not poor widower, confiding by constraint in the wife of an ignorant hind who has been working mostly underground all his life, and yet at whose door death had never knocked, and at whose poor table four sons daily sit, but poor little fellow. Those words being on his lips, it occurred to him, and it is an instance of the strong attraction with which his hopes, and fears and all his thoughts were tending to one center, that a great temptation was being placed in this woman's way. Her infant was a boy too. Now, would it be possible for her to change them? Though he was soon satisfied that he had dismissed the idea as romantic and unlikely though possible, there was no denying he could not help pursuing it so far as to entertain within himself a picture of what his condition would be if he should discover such an imposture when he was grown old. Whether a man so situated would be able to pluck away the result of so many years of usage, confidence, and belief from the impostor, and endow a stranger with it? But it was idle speculating thus. It couldn't happen. In a moment afterwards he determined that it could, but that such women were constantly observed, and had no opportunity given them for the accomplishment of such a design, even when they were so wicked as to entertain it. In another moment, he was remembering how few such cases seemed to have ever happened. In another moment he was wondering whether they ever happened, and were not found out. As his unusual emotion subsided, these misgivings gradually melted away, though so much of their shadow remained behind, that he was constant in his resolution to look closely after Richards himself, without appearing to do so. Being now in an easier frame of mind, he regarded the woman's station as rather an advantageous circumstance than otherwise, by placing, in itself, a broad distance between her and the child, and rendering their separation easy and natural. Thence he passed to the contemplation of the future glories of Domni and son, and dismissed the memory of his wife, for the time being, with a tributary sigh or two. Meanwhile, terms were ratified and agreed upon between Mrs. Chick and Richards, with the assistance of Miss Tox, and Richards being with much ceremony invested with the Domni baby, as if it were an order, resigned her own, with many tears and kisses, to Jemima. Glasses of wine were then produced, to sustain the drooping spirits of the family, and Miss Tox, busying herself in dispensing tastes to the younger branches, bred them up to their father's business with such surprising expedition, that she made chokers of four of them in a quarter of a minute. "You'll take a glass yourself, sir, won't you?" " said Miss Tox, as Tootle appeared. "Thankee, mum," said Tootle, "since you are suppressing. And you're very glad to leave your dear good wife in such a comfortable home, ain't you, sir?" " said Miss Tox, nodding, and winking at him stealthily. "No, mum," said Tootle. "Here's wishing of her back a gin." Polly cried more than ever at this. So Mrs. Chick, who had her matronly apprehensions that this indulgence in grief might be prejudicial to the little Domni acid, "Indeed, she whispered Miss Tox, "hastened to the rescue. Your little child will thrive charmingly with your sister Jemima, Richards," said Mrs. Chick, "and you have only to make an effort. This is a world of effort, you know, Richards, to be very happy indeed. You have been already measured for your mourning, haven't you, Richards?"
"Yes, ma'am," sobbed Polly. "And it'll fit beautifully."
"I know," said Mrs. Chick, "for the same young person has made me many dresses. The very best materials too."
"Lor, you'll be so smart," said Miss Tox, "that your husband won't know you, will you, sir?"
"I should know her," said Tootle, gruffly, "anyhows and anywheres."
Tootle was evidently not to be bought over. "As to living, Richards, you know," pursued Mrs. Chick, "why, the very best of everything will be at your disposal. You will order your little dinner every day, and anything you take a fancy to, I'm sure will be as readily provided, as if you were a lady."
"Yes, to be sure," said Miss Tox, keeping up the ball with great sympathy. "And as to porter, quite unlimited, will it not, Louia?"
"Certainly."
Returned Mrs. Chick in the same tone. "With a little abstinence, you know, my dear, in point of vegetables."
"And pickles, perhaps," suggested Miss Tox.
"With such exceptions," said Louia, "she'll consult her choice entirely, and be under no restraint at all, my love."
"And then, of course, you know," said Miss Tox, "however fond she is of her own dear little child, and I'm sure, Louia, you don't blame her for being fond of it?"
"Oh no. Cried Mrs. Chick, benignantly.
"Still," resumed Miss Tox, "she naturally must be interested in her young charge, and must consider it a privilege, to see a little cherub connected with the superior classes, gradually unfolding itself from day to day at one common fountain, is it not so, Louia?"
"Most undoubtedly."
Said Mrs. Chick. "You see, my love, she's already quite contented and comfortable, and means to say goodbye to her sister Jemima and her little pets, and her good honest husband, with a light heart and a smile, don't she, my dear?"
"Oh yes.
Cried Miss Tox. "To be sure she does."
Notwithstanding which, however, poor Polly embraced them all round in great distress, and coming to her spouse at last,
could not make up her mind to part from him until he gently disengaged himself at the close of the following allegorical piece of consolation. Polly, old Newman, whatever you do, my darling, hold up your head and fight low. That's the only rule as I know on that'll carry anyone through life. You always have held up your head and fought low, Polly. Do it now, or bricks is no longer so. God bless you, Polly. Me and Jemima will do your duty by you, and with relating to yarn, hold up your head and fight low, Polly, and you can't go wrong. Apostrophe apostrophe, fortified by this golden secret, Polly finally ran away, to avoid any more particular leave-taking between herself and the children. But the stratagem hardly succeeded as well as it deserved. For the smallest boy, but one divining her intent, immediately began swarming upstairs after her, if that word of doubtful etymology be admissible, on his arms and legs, while the eldest, known in the family by the name of Byler, in remembrance of the steam engine, beat a demoniacal tattoo with his boots, expressive of grief, in which he was joined by the rest of the family. A quantity of oranges and halfpence thrust indiscriminately on each young Tootle checked the first violence of their regret, and the family were speedily transported to their own home by means of the hackney coach kept in waiting for that purpose. The children, under the guardianship of Jemima, blocked up the window and dropped out oranges and halfpence all the way along. Mr. Tootle himself preferred to ride behind among the spikes, as being the mode of conveyance to which he was best accustomed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.